In NPR's business report, Richard Block, one of the founders of the nation's largest tax preparation companies, H&R Block, died yesterday in Kansas City of heart failure. He was 78 years old. NPR's Greg Allen has more.
In 1954, Richard Block and his brother Henry were operating a company that provided a variety of services to small businesses when the Internal Revenue Service announced it would no longer fill out returns for taxpayers. The Blocks soon scrapped their old company and replaced it with a new business specializing in preparing income tax returns. The company grew quickly, opening offices around the country. In 1962, H&R Block went public. Today it serves more than 21 million clients in 11,000 retail offices around the world. Richard Block remained closely involved with the company until 1978, when he was diagnosed with lung cancer and told he had just months to live. He beat the disease and devoted the rest of his life to helping others fight cancer. He helped create the National Cancer Hotline and supported projects through the R.A. Block Cancer Foundation. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kansas City.
According to a new report, Houston-based Halliburton's oil deliveries in the Middle East cost U.S. taxpayers an extra $166 million. The report comes from the U.S. House Government Reform Committee's Democratic staff. Halliburton spokeswoman Wendy Hall says price comparisons used in the report are unfair. She says Halliburton unit KBR is seeking copies of the successor contract given to the Pentagon's Defense Energy Support Center in order to comment. Also, congressional investigators say the Army botched planning and management of the multi-billion-dollar contract to provide food and other services to troops in Iraq. Government's Accountability Office investigators also criticized Halliburton's staff and accounting. But Hall says Halliburton followed constantly changing directions and requirements from military officials. Mitsubishi says it's cutting 1,200 workers from its assembly plant in Illinois. Tom Rogers of member station WILL reports.
The plant in the town of Normal is Mitsubishi's only U.S. manufacturing operation. It currently employs more than 3,100 workers. The Japanese automaker has been struggling through slow sales, bad credit decisions, and a controversy in Japan over recalls. Last spring, Mitsubishi had announced a reorganization plan. It didn't include U.S. layoffs, but it spawned rumors of cutbacks at the Normal plant, which makes the Endeavor, Gallant, and Eclipse models. The head of the area's Economic Development Agency believes that Normal and its twin city Bloomington can absorb the blow caused by the layoffs. The area is home to State Farm Insurance and Illinois State University. For NPR News, I'm Tom Rogers in Urbana, Illinois.
The Mortgage Bankers Association is reporting that new applications for U.S. mortgages fell last week for the second week in a row. This occurred even though mortgage rates for most loans were flat to lower. The association says its seasonally adjusted market index, a measure of mortgage activity, was down last week from the previous week. The lower number of mortgage applications comes after news on Tuesday that June housing starts fell unexpectedly to their lowest levels in over a year. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress that housing starts were weak, but that was to be expected after having grown at an extraordinary pace in recent years. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Coming up at 10:30 this morning, we'll have live coverage from National Public Radio of the 9/11 Commission, releasing its report today on the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. That means that Focus 580 will not be heard in its usual form today. 83 degrees, the temperature outside of our studios here on Friends Plaza. Partly sunny, warm, very humid today in Champaign, Urbana. High 88.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. The bipartisan commission investigating the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, has released its final report. The commission's work over the last 20 months could go a long way to help shape the future of America's response to terrorism. It also changes some of what we thought we knew about that September morning. Here, some of the key moments in the narrative of September 11th, adding what is now known about the plot, the hijackers, and America's response.
Hi, Boston Center TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York, and we need you guys to, we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there to help us out.
Is this real world or exercise?
No, this is not an exercise manifest.
Those were civilian and military flight controllers monitoring American Airlines Flight 11. Preliminary staff reports of the 9/11 Commission say the Air Defense of America began with this call. To most Americans, the idea that terrorists would hijack a plane and use it as a weapon was unimaginable. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said as much at a press conference the following spring.
I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon, that they would try to use a hijacked airplane as a missile.
Inside the U.S. intelligence community, this kind of hijacking was not a new idea, according to the 9/11 Commission staff.
Amid the thousands of threat reports, some mentioned aircraft in the years before 9/11. Threat reports mentioned the possibility of using an aircraft laden with explosives. Of these, the most prominent asserted a possible plot to fly an explosives-laden aircraft into a U.S. city. In early 95, Abdul Hakim Murad, Ramzi Youssef's accomplice in the Manila Airlines bombing plot, told Philippine authorities that he and Youssef had discussed flying a plane into CIA headquarters. These past episodes suggest possibilities.
There were other hints. Novelist Tom Clancy had detailed how a commercial plane destroys the Capitol in his 1994 book, Dead of Honor. By 2001, an FBI agent in Phoenix, Arizona, alerted FBI headquarters that he suspected Osama bin Laden might be trying to send operatives to the United States to attend civil aviation school. The 9/11 Commission staff noted that this Phoenix memo was not shared outside the FBI. 1 month later, in August, the CIA briefed the president. The PDB, or Presidential Daily Brief, was entitled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S. It speaks of, quote, preparations for hijackings. The White House has said the PDB wasn't specific enough. Condoleezza Rice defended the Bush administration during her testimony before the commission in April.
There was nothing in this memo that suggested that an attack was coming on New York or Washington, D.C. There was nothing in this memo as to time, place, how, or where. This was not a threat report to the president or a threat report to
me.
The 9/11 Commission staff reports say the origins of the 9/11 plot go back to 1996.
Nobody moves. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any move, you'll danger yourself and the airplane. Let's stay quiet.
A hijacker from American Airlines Flight 11. That plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center. United Airlines Flight 175 was hurtling south along the Hudson River, and it hit the South Tower. Investigators would eventually learn that 19 men hijacked four airplanes that day. Understanding of these men and their plot was at first wrong in key respects. FBI Director Robert Mueller told Congress a full year after the attacks that the terrorists, quote, came lawfully, they lived lawfully, they trained lawfully, they boarded the aircraft lawfully. A report from the staff of the 9/11 Commission says otherwise. The hijackers
presented passports, manipulated in a fraudulent manner, made detectable false statements on their visa applications, made false statements to border officials to gain entry to the United States, and violated immigration laws while inside the United States.
And now there is video footage of four hijackers setting off metal detectors at a Washington airport. Security officers check them with handheld detectors before allowing them to continue to their gate. The 19 hijackers weren't particularly well disciplined. The 9/11 Commission reports that, quote, the 9/11 conspirators confronted operational difficulties, internal disagreements, and even dissenting opinions within the leadership of al-Qaeda. It was also widely reported at the time that al-Qaeda was bankrolled by Osama bin Laden's millions. The 9/11 Commission staff says bin Laden, quote, received about $1 million per year, a significant sum, but hardly a $300 million fortune that could be used to fund a global jihad, unquote.
Military Boston Center just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and it's on its way towards heading towards Washington.
Okay, American 11 is still in the air?
Yes, there was definitely another aircraft that hit the tower. That's the latest report we have.
On September 11th, after the Trade Center and the Pentagon had been hit, only one hijacked flight was still in the air, United Flight 93. Popular myth has it that that plane could have been shot down. Vice President Dick Cheney spoke about the response to Flight 93 days later on NBC.
The president made the decision on my recommendation as well, wholeheartedly concurred in the decision he made, that if the plane would not divert, if they wouldn't pay any attention to instructions to move away from the city, as a last resort, our pilots were authorized to take him out.
On September 11th, one of Flight 93's hijackers spoke on the radio as the plane flew towards Washington.
Hi, the captain. I would like to remain seated. We're all aboard and are going to back to the airport and we have our demand, so please remain quiet.
Please remain quiet, said the hijacker. Military and civilian air controllers were actually confused about what planes were and were not in the air. At one point, they were still tracking American Airlines Flight 11, though it had already crashed into the Trade Center.
Okay, so American 11 isn't a hijack at all then, right?
No, he is a hijack.
American 11 is a hijack.
Yes.
And he's going into Washington?
This could be a third aircraft.
Civilian flight controllers, meanwhile, were still considering whether to ask for military assistance.
Do we want to think about scrambling aircraft?
Oh, God, I don't know.
That's a decision somebody's going to have to make probably in the next 10 minutes.
Everybody just left the room.
In a vain attempt to hunt down the phantom aircraft of American Airlines Flight 11, the 9/11 Commission staff reports two fighters were quickly scrambled from Washington's Langley Air Force Base. A preliminary 9/11 Commission report says, quote, the existing protocol was unsuited in every respect. Continuing, what ensued was the hurried attempt to create an improvised defense by officials who had never encountered or trained against the situation they faced. That report goes on to say,
the vice president was mistaken in his belief that shoot-down authorization had been passed to the pilots flying at NORAD's direction.
And this,
NORAD officials have maintained that they would have intercepted and shot down United 93. We are not so sure.
One last vision of September 11th, 2001. Every account marveled at the crisp air and clean blue sky that promised a perfect fall day. On this point, the 9/11 Commission staff report agrees. In its words, the day of Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, began for the U.S. civil aviation as one marked by exceptionally fine weather across the country. The time is 19 minutes past the hour.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. And you're listening to Morning Edition on WILL Urbana, public radio coming to you from the campus of the University of Illinois. At 10:30, we'll have live coverage from National Public Radio of the 9/11 Commission as it releases its final report on the attacks of 2001. Coming up this weekend, we'll have a special program that also looks at the issue of intelligence. It's a program called Intelligence Failure from Pearl Harbor to 9/11 and Iraq. It's a program from America Abroad, and it examines intelligence failures from the origins of the CIA CIA to the 9/11 attacks and the controversy surrounding Iraq. Using rare archival audio, the program looks at when and why intelligence failures occur. Join Garrick Utley, Steve Roberts, and Margaret Warner for Intelligence Failure from Pearl Harbor to 9/11 and Iraq, Saturday afternoon at 5, here on AM 580. The temperature outside of our studios on Friends Plaza here in Urbana now 84 degrees. We're expecting today it will be partly sunny, warm, quite humid, with a chance of showers and thunderstorms developing this afternoon, and heavy rainfall is possible. Tonight, cloudy, with showers and storms likely, with heavy rain again possible, the low 65. Tomorrow, intervals of clouds and sun, cooler, with a few showers, especially during the morning. We expect a high of 77 degrees. Time now, 21 minutes past 10.
For years, health planners have been talking about electronic health records, standardized computerized information. Yesterday in Washington, the Secretary of Health and Human Services kicked off a meeting on health information technology. Tommy Thompson announced plans for establishing a uniform electronic health record within 10 years. NPR's Joanne Silberna reports on how such records might change things for patients and doctors.
The Department of Health and Human Services estimates that only 13% of hospitals use electronic medical records. The percentage of doctors' practices isn't much higher. Physician Paul Tang chaired a national committee on using computers to reduce medical errors. He was at the Health Information Conference in Washington. Tang says patients don't realize how bad things are.
One Stanford study, we looked at information used in ambulatory care visits, and up to 81% of the time, the physicians taking care of a patient didn't have the information they needed to make decisions on that patient for that visit.
Tang says that's not good for patients or doctors.
11% of the time, they went out of the exam room and actually paged, let's say, the cardiologist and asked, well, what were the results of that treadmill test? A quarter of the time, they had to sort of ask the patient, well, what did you think went on? You know, and the rest of the time, they either made decisions without the information, they said, come back in 2 weeks and maybe we will have the information, or they repeated the test.
David Koopman also came to hear the announcement in two capacities. One as a health information consultant. The other was to tell his own story to reporters covering the meeting. Koopman has a heart arrhythmia. While driving to work one morning, he nearly fainted, and he drove himself to the closest hospital. He was hospitalized for 3 days. During that time, the staff cardiologist couldn't get Koopman's medical records.
This resulted in an extra day of hospitalization, redundant procedures, redundant tests, all totaling approximately $8,000 to $10,000.
After Koopman's discharge, he says the whole thing happened in reverse.
I had to physically drive to the suburban hospital and get my own files and hand carry them to my cardiologist in Boston.
That won't happen in 10 years if the administration's plans go through, says Dr. David Brailer. He's the government's national coordinator for health information technology. Brailer says the hospital would just swipe Koopman's identification card or number through a computer and see his medical history. Brailer says even routine medical care would be simpler.
The patient could have a, quote, encounter by not leaving their home. They could do it from their office over the web or from home over the telephone. If they did have to go in, they would have their information available when they walked in. They would see their clinician, spend a lot of time talking about their illness, about the things that they need to do, about their preferences, and walk to the pharmacy or wherever else they need to be to get their prescription. No information transmittal, no forms to fill out, nothing else needs to be done except spend time with the doctor.
There are major hurdles to be overcome before universal electronic health records are a reality. One is, who will pay for the system? Yesterday, the administration proposed setting up grants for pilot systems and loans for health providers ready to go electronic. Physician Paul Tang says one concern, privacy, may be out of the way because of a new federal law protecting patients' records and because of technology.
In an electronic world, we can protect patients' confidential information better than on paper, where anybody can read it and I don't know. In the computerized world, we actually keep audits to know who's seen what, and we can use that to enforce our privacy policies. We didn't have that tool before.
By October, Secretary of Health and Human Services Tommy Thompson is expecting a report from a committee of advisors that will describe more precisely how an electronic health record system would work and how it would be paid for. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
Some senior scientists are criticizing the way the Bush administration makes decisions on science policy. The Union of Concerned Scientists issued a report this month accusing the administration of distorting the science advisory process so that the president will only hear the advice he wants to hear. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Every administration gets to pick the kind of advisors it wants to hear from, so it's reasonable to ask whether the Bush administration is doing anything all that different from any other White House.
I think it really is different from any of the administrations that I've worked with, which goes all the way back to John Kennedy.
Lewis Branscombe of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government has gotten jobs from both Democratic and Republican presidents. He says the difference in this administration is its willingness to fire scientific advisors for speaking what Branscombe says are scientific truths. He says a particularly egregious example came earlier this year when Elizabeth Blackburn was not reappointed to the President's Council on Bioethics. Branscombe says Blackburn's sin was offering accurate advice on embryonic stem cell research, an area of research the President has limited.
I would have no objection at all to the President having a committee of ethicists or even a committee of religious people who advise him on what the various religions think about the subject. But it's coding these more subjective judgments with the cloak of science and doing it by not treating the science objectively that I think is truly objectionable.
But administration officials deny that's happening. White House science advisor Jack Marburger spoke Wednesday at a National Academy panel looking into the presidential science advisory process. Marburger doesn't deny that people like to strengthen their positions by an appeal to science.
Every time you see an advertisement for some product being touted by someone in a white jacket with a little badge and a stethoscope or whatever is trying to exploit science to make their case, we have to be clear about the difference between this kind of artificial use of science and the real role that science plays in policy making.
Marburger says the president believes scientists should always speak the truth to the best of their ability and not worry about the consequences. But critics claim that even when the Bush administration gets good scientific advice, that advice is ignored. Harvard Medical School's Michael Green says two advisory committees to the Food and Drug Administration voted 24-3 to recommend that a morning after contraceptive, called Plan B, be sold without a prescription. But Green says the acting director of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research rejected that.
His decision was contrary in this case, not only to the advice of his advisory committee, but also to the advice of his staff people, who came to the conclusion, the same conclusions the advisory committee did, that the application should be approved.
Green admits that science advice can only take you so far in policymaking. And that's White House science advisor Jack Marburger's point. Science is rarely so clear-cut that it absolutely dictates policy decisions.
It is assumed when you accept an appointment by an administration whose policy principles are clear that you will accept those principles or that you will agree to serve. So if you don't, you shouldn't take the job.
Marburger, who just happens to be a lifelong Democrat, says he understood that when he took his job and doesn't feel his ability to speak scientific truths has been compromised. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
The time is 29 minutes past the hour.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll have live coverage from National Public Radio of the 9/11 Commission releasing its final report today officially in Washington, D.C. The panel members will be there. The two chairs, the chair and the co-chair, will make comments, and then they'll be taking questions from reporters. And we expect that that will go at least an hour. And of course, it's preempting our regular edition of Focus 580 this morning. We will be talking about the 9/11 Commission on Focus next week with Stephen Strasser. He is a former correspondent for Newsweek magazine who spent a lot of time going through the reports that the committee issued and has edited a book that brings all this information together, which is called The 9/11 Investigations. And we'll be talking with him on Focus 580 one week from today, next Thursday, July 29th, 11 o'clock hour. So you might want to tune in for that. We're expecting another very warm and humid day. Today here in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny, very warm, high of 88, also a chance of thunderstorms developing this afternoon with the possibility of some heavy rain. So stay tuned here to AM 580 for more on the weather throughout the day. Right now, 83 degrees at 10:30.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., I'm Scott Simon with a special report. The National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission, will present its report in just a few moments. The commission has called a press conference for 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time in the Mellon Auditorium on Constitution Avenue in Washington, D.C. The commission has been working for well over a year now to try to provide a detailed recounting of the events and policies leading up to and including the attacks of September 11, 2001, and to forward recommendations to help prevent future terrorist attacks. The report apparently is a little bit more than 560 pages long. Beginning today, it will be available on the Commission's website. It will also be available for sale in the government printing office and many bookstores. We're told the purchase price is $10. Former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane heads the commission. He will make the opening remarks, followed by former Congressman Lee Hamilton of Indiana, who is the commission's vice chair. The floor will then be open for questions from all 10 commissioners. NPR's intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly joins us in our studios. Mary Louise, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Scott.
And the two phrases that I think a lot of people have perhaps circled already on the basis of preliminary reports are shocked but not surprised, the reaction they say that the American people might have been expected to have to the attacks of September 11th, and also that there was a failure of imagination.
That's the way that they characterize it as their sort of overall finding, yes. It says the most important failure was one of imagination. We do not believe leaders understood the gravity of the threat. So the commission trying to be very careful here in terms of not placing blame one place or the other.
Governor Kane and Congressman Hamilton were at the podium.
The United States Congress and the American people. This report represents the unanimous conclusion of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States. On September 11, 2001, 19 men armed with knives, box cutters, mace, and pepper spray penetrated the defenses of the most powerful nation in the world. They inflicted unbearable trauma on our people, and at the same time, they turned the international order upside down. At this point, we would like to ask you to remember for a moment how you felt that day. The grief, the enormous sense of loss, but remember also how we came together that day as a nation. Young and old, rich and poor, didn't matter whether you were a Republican or a Democrat, we had a deep sense of hurt. But out of that came a deep sense of purpose. We knew what we had to do as a nation to respond, and we did. But it's also fair to say that on that September day, we were unprepared. We did not grasp the magnitude of a threat that had been gathering over a considerable period of time. As we detail in our report, this was a failure of policy, management, capability, and above all, a failure of imagination. Now, we recognize, as commissioners, that we have the benefit of hindsight. And since the plotters were flexible and resourceful, we cannot know whether any single step or series of steps would have defeated them. What we can say with a good deal of confidence is that none of the measures adopted by the United States government before 9/11 disturbed or even delayed the progress of the al-Qaeda plot. There were several unexploited opportunities. Our government did not watch list future hijackers, Hazmi and Midhoff, before they arrived in the United States, or take adequate steps to find them once they were here. Our government did not link the arrest of Zakarias Moussaoui, described as interested in flight training for the purpose of using an airplane as a terrorist act, to the heightened indications of attack. Our government did not discover false statements on visa applications or recognize passports that were manipulated in a fraudulent manner. Our government did not expand no-fly lists to include names from terrorist watch lists or require airline passengers to be more thoroughly screened. These examples make up part of a broader national security picture where the government failed to protect the American people. The United States government was simply not active enough in combating the terrorist threat before 9/11. Our diplomacy and foreign policy failed to extract bin Laden from his Afghan sanctuary. Our military forces and covert action capabilities did not have the options on the table to defeat al-Qaeda or kill or capture either bin Laden or his top lieutenants. Our intelligence and law enforcement agencies did not manage or share information or effectively follow leads to keep pace with a very nimble enemy. Our border, immigration, and aviation security agencies were not integrated into the counterterrorism effort. And much of our response on the day of 9/11 was improvised and ineffective, even as extraordinary individual acts of heroism saved countless lives. Our failures took place over many years and administrations. There's no single individual who is responsible for our failures. Yet individuals and institutions cannot be absolved of responsibility. Any person in a senior position within our government during this time bears some element of responsibility for our government's actions. Having said that, it is not our purpose to assign blame. As we said at the outset, we look back so that we can look forward. Our goal is to prevent future attacks. Every expert with whom we spoke told us an attack of even greater magnitude is now possible and even probable. We do not have the luxury of time. We must prepare and we must act. The al-Qaeda network and its affiliates are sophisticated, patient, disciplined, and lethal. Osama bin Laden built an infrastructure and organization that was able to attract, train, and use recruits against even more ambitious targets. He rallied new zealots with each demonstration of al-Qaeda's capability. His message and his hate-filled ideology have instructed and inspired untold recruits and imitators. He and al-Qaeda despise America and its policies. They exploit political grievances and hopelessnesses within the Arab and Islamic world. They indoctrinate the disaffected and pervert one of the great world's great religions. And they seek creative methods to kill Americans in limitless numbers, including if they can do it with the use of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Put simply, the United States is faced with one of the greatest security challenges in our long history. We have struck blows against the terrorists since 9/11. We have, we believe, prevented attacks on the homeland. We do believe we are safer today than we were on 9/11, but we are not safe. Because al-Qaeda represents an ideology, not a finite group of people, we should not expect the danger to recede greatly as years to come. No matter whom we kill or capture, including Osama bin Laden himself, there will be still those who plot against us. Bin Laden has inspired affiliates and imitators. The societies they prey on are vulnerable, the terrorist ideology is potent, and the means for inflicting harm are readily available. We cannot let our guard down. Congressman Hamilton.
Former Congressman Lee Hamilton.
Before continuing our narrative, may I simply rise to a point of personal privilege to say what remarkable leadership we have had from the chairman of this commission. One of these days, I'm going to create a public servant hall of fame, Tom, and you're going to go in on the first ballot, I assure you. And we've had remarkable support from a dedicated group of commissioners and a highly talented staff headed by Dr. Zelikow and Chris Kojum and Dan Marcus and others. and we are deeply indebted to them, as Tom will say again in a few minutes. I begin with the recommendations. This commission, of course, does not have all of the answers, but we have thought about what to do, a global strategy, and how to do it, a different way of organizing our government. But based on our thorough review of the government's performance and our examination of the enemy, we recommend the following elements for a counterterrorism strategy. This strategy must be balanced. It must integrate all the elements of national power, diplomacy, intelligence, covert action, law enforcement, economic policy, foreign aid, homeland defense, and military strength. There is no silver bullet or decisive blow that can defeat Islamist terrorism. It will take unity of effort and sustained and effective use of every tool at our disposal. We need to play offense, to kill or to capture the terrorists, deny them sanctuaries, and disrupt their ability to move money and people around the globe. We need to ensure that the key countries like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are stable, capable, and resolute in opposing terrorism. We need to sustain a coalition of nations that cooperates bilaterally and multilaterally with us in the counterterrorism mission. We need a better dialogue between the West and the Islamic world. We also highlight the need to restrict and roll back the proliferation of the world's most dangerous weapons. We need to put forth an agenda of opportunity, economic, educational, political, so that young people in the Arab and Islamic world have peaceful and productive avenues for expression and hope. We need to join the battle of ideas within the Islamic world, communicating hope instead of despair, progress in place of persecution, life instead of death. This message should be matched by policies that encourage and support the majority of Muslims who share these goals. At home, we need to set clear priorities for the protection of our infrastructure and the security of our transportation. Resources should be allocated based upon those priorities, and standards of preparedness should be set. The private sector and local governments should play an important part in this process. We need secure borders with heightened and uniform standards of identification for those entering and exiting the country, and an immigration system able to be efficient, allowing good people in while keeping the terrorists out. If, God forbid, there is another attack, we must be ready to respond. We must educate the public, train and equip our first responders, and anticipate countless scenarios. We recommend significant changes in the organization of government. We know that the quality of the people is more important than the quality of the wiring diagrams. Good people can overcome bad structures. They should not have to. Day and night, dedicated public servants are waging the struggle to combat terrorists and protect the homeland. We need to ensure that our government maximizes their efforts through information sharing, coordinated effort, and clear authority. A critical theme that emerged throughout our inquiry was the difficulty of answering the question, who is in charge? Who ensures that agencies pool resources, avoid duplication, and plan jointly? Who oversees the massive integration and unity of effort necessary to keep America safe? Too often, the answer is no one. Thus, we are recommending a national counterterrorism center. We need effective unity of effort on counterterrorism. We should create a national counterterrorism center to unify all counterterrorism intelligence and operations across the foreign and the domestic divide in one organization. Right now, these efforts are too diffuse across the government. They need to be unified. We recommend a national intelligence director. We need unity of effort in the intelligence community. We need a much stronger head of the intelligence community and an intelligence community that organizes itself to do joint work in national mission centers. We need reforms of the kind the military had two decades ago. We need a Goldwater-Nichols reform for the intelligence community. The intelligence community needs a shift in mindset and organization so that intelligence agencies operate under the principle of joint command, with information sharing as the norm. We need reform in the United States Congress. We need unity of effort in the Congress. Right now, authority and responsibility are too diffuse. The intelligence committees do not have enough power to perform effectively their oversight work. Oversight for homeland security is splintered among too many committees. We need much stronger committees performing oversight of intelligence. And we need a single committee in each chamber providing oversight of the Department of Homeland Security. We need reform in the FBI. We need a stronger national security workforce within the FBI. We do not support the creation of a new domestic intelligence agency. What the FBI needs is a specialized and integrated national security workforce consisting of agents, analysts, linguists, and surveillance specialists. These specialists need to be recruited, trained, rewarded, and retained to ensure the development of an institutional culture with deep expertise in intelligence and national security. We need changes in information sharing. We need unity of effort in that task. The United States government has access to vast amounts of information, but it has a weak process, a weak system of processing and using that information. Need to share must replace need to know. And we need a better process for transitions between one administration and another for national security officials, so that this nation does not lower its guard every 4 or 8 years. These and other recommendations are spelled out in great detail in our report. We have made a limited number of recommendations, focusing on the areas we believe most critical. We are acutely sensitive to the need to vigorously protect our liberties as we secure and guard our security. We endorse many of the actions taken in the wake of 9/11 to facilitate government action and information sharing. But we stress that these measures need to be accompanied by a commitment to our open society and the principle of review, safeguards that are built into the process and accompanied by vigorous oversight. We must, after all is said and done, preserve the liberties that we are fighting for.
Thank you, Congressman Hamilton, one of the most decent and thoughtful
Chairman Kane again.
I've ever had the pleasure to know.
Before we close, we offer just a few more thoughts. We approached our task with a deep respect for the place of September 11th in our nation's history. We have compared the shock, some have compared the shock we felt to Pearl Harbor, others to the Kennedy assassination. There are no comparisons. This was a moment unique in its horror in our long history. As in every 4 years in this democracy, we are in the midst of a presidential campaign. Our two great parties will disagree, and that is right, and that is proper. At the same time, on this subject, we must unite to make our country safer. Republicans and Democrats must unite in this cause. The American people must be prepared for a long and difficult struggle. We face a determined enemy who sees this as a war of attrition, indeed as an epical struggle. We expect further attacks. Against such an enemy, there can be no complacency. This is the challenge of our generation. As Americans, we must step forward and we must meet that challenge. We have reviewed as a commission 2.5 million pages of documents. We've interviewed over 1,200 individuals, including experts and officials past and present. Our work has been assisted by a superb staff. Each one of these professionals has provided dedication and expertise that has often exceeded our very highest expectations. And we also had the honor of working with an extraordinary group of Americans, our commissioners. Each has shown skill, determination, and collegiality. We close, most importantly, by thanking the families who lost loved ones on 9/11. You demanded the creation of this commission. You have encouraged us every step of the way as partners and as witnesses. From your grief, you have drawn strength. You have given that strength to us. And we are determined, as you instructed us, to do everything possible to prevent other families from ever suffering such a tragedy again. On that beautiful September day, we felt great hurt, but we believed and we acted as one nation. We united as Americans have always united in the face of any common foe. Five Republicans and five Democrats have come together today with that same unity of purpose. We file no additional views in this report. We have no dissents. We have each decided that we will play no active role in the fall presidential campaign. We will instead devote our time, as we have, to work together in support of the recommendations in this report. You see, we believe that acting together as Republicans and Democrats, we can make a difference. We can make our nation safer. We can make our nation more secure. We'd be happy to take your questions.
Commission Chairman, former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane. Questions now.
He didn't qualify.
Why was it that you decided as a commission not to say whether the attacks could have been prevented or not prevented, given all the information that you have accumulated over the 20 months?
Excuse me, I didn't hear the beginning of the question. It's coming out now. I think the microphone didn't work well. Could you repeat the question?
Why was there no determination about whether the attacks could have been prevented or not prevented, given all of the information that you have accumulated over the past 20 months?
What we did is present the facts as we learned them. As you look at these facts, time after time, you will find, as we detailed, people who got in to this country who should not have gotten in, because that travel documents didn't earn that distinction. We document intelligence agencies who didn't share information. We document actions by the government that should have been taken and were not taken. But you asked, would any single one of these things, or even in combination, are we sure that if they had occurred in a different way, that 9/11 would have prevented? I can't say we are sure. We do not know. We think it's possible. But we have not drawn that absolute conclusion because we don't believe that absolute conclusion is justified by the facts.
Hi, John Diamond, USA Today. Going through the report, the findings seem to focus on a whole array of problems. The proposals for solution are focused narrowly in structural solutions, changes in the shape of government. The families are already being quoted today as saying that they view this as very, very important. Their next step will be to see that these are implemented. I'm wondering if there's any concern that it's kind of a false promise, the idea that if the structure is fixed, that, as you say, Mr. Chairman, that there will not be or may not be another attack such as this, that structural reform is the answer to preventing another 9/11.
I think the report is much broader than your question might suggest. You are correct that an important part of the report focuses on organizational change in the executive branch and in the Congress. And in my remarks a moment ago, I emphasized those. But in the complete report, we recognize the necessity of doing a number of things to attack the terrorists, to deny them sanctuaries, to provide stability and security in the key countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. We have a section in the report on the trying to prevent the growth of terrorism. And this is a very formidable challenge, as all of you can appreciate, because what it means is we have to engage in ideas with the Muslim world. We have to develop American policies that we understand the consequences of. We need to put together all of the elements of a counterterrorism strategy, which I identified, I think, a little earlier. And we recommend a number of steps to be taken to protect against and to prepare for terrorist attacks. So if you look at all of the report, you will find a good many recommendations beyond those relating to the organization of government, dealing with American foreign policy, dealing with how you respond to attacks, dealing with the important question of the security of our borders and immigration policy, dealing with the question of terrorist financing, and, of course, law enforcement and many other matters. I think it's a very complete and comprehensive report. The report, of course, is driven by the mandate of the Commission. We did not choose the mandate. It was given to us. And the statute identifies the areas that we are to approach, to make recommendations on, and that is what we've done to the best of our ability.
Congressman Roma.
What we have tried to do in making recommendations,
former Democratic Congressman Tim Romer of Indiana,
only at the boxes.